There's value in having a chance to think about a question, think about something, to wonder about it, and talk to someone who has some training in that regard. And I certainly enjoy these kinds of discussions. So the floor is now open for questions, either about the doctrine of Buddhism or about your practice experience. Brandon, did you have any questions from your... You just came back from a Goenka retreat, right?
Yeah. No questions.
Anything you want to share about it?
It's a lot.
Yeah. I mean,
what to point out, I don't really know.
Okay.
It was interesting to see that everything about the journey was internal. Because once you locked into the boot camp type schedule, everything else was inside.
Yep.
There wasn't anything, I mean, if the outside was scheduled. It was the same thing every day.
Yep.
So everything that was going on was on the inside.
Yeah, he terms it psychological surgery, right?
Yeah.
It's, and this is... teacher who's no longer alive, but named S.N. Goenka, and I've been on several retreats of his. I know John has been on. Anybody else here? No.
I've been on one in England.
You've been on one in England.
I'm thinking of doing, signing up for this one in June up at Georgia.
Okay, good.
It's a really nice place. Yeah, it's really nice. Oh, I can't say that. You have your own room.
That's what I was told.
You have your own bathroom. You have your... they don't open up your cell until like the ninth day. You have a locked cell that you can meditate in, but they don't let you go in there until about the ninth day. And the facility is just beautiful, and the people that take care of it are wonderful. The whole place is just magnificent.
Right.
Your room is spotless. Of course, you clean it when you leave, but you know you're wiping off dust.
Yeah,
yeah. There's really nothing there.
See, in Hereford, the first time you go, you get your own room, generally. But if you go a second time, they've got communal rooms, and the bath and showering is communal. And it's, I mean, it's all free, so you don't, it doesn't matter, but it's not luxury living kind of thing.
Yeah.
The food is exceptional, except they put onions in everything. So the whole meditation hall is gurgling, and I knew that's what it was, because I mean most of us probably eat like that often enough, but the onions were really you could hear everybody's belly.
And this there are different approaches to the practice of meditation, mindfulness meditation, particularly Vipassana. And this is one that's been very popular. It's one of the most popular in the world. And it what's called body scanning. I've been, like I said, I've been on several retreats. It's been my primary practice for years. If you're interested, if you go to the archives on the website, I've recorded guided body scan meditations and given Dharma talks about it. So something to think about. Yeah, April.
Yeah, I have a question about that. So I haven't done a Goenka retreat yet. And I know Yuval Noah Harari, that was, that's his, he went to Goenka retreat. That's how he started his meditation practice. And then I've been doing some research on different meditation styles and techniques. So I'm wondering, when you're currently now where you're at with your practice, when you're doing like a 1 to 2 hour sit, are you doing the like kind of the breath close, you know, paying attention to the breath at the nose, like you talk about with the jhana preparation? Or are you doing, because I don't know yet exactly the Goenka body sweep style, are you doing your own body scan? Are you like alternating through that hour or two?
Actually, I'll talk about the 45-minute sit tonight.
Okay.
Now, I've been training with this for a long time. So I have some abilities that come about as a result of training. So, and I'm talking about what I do. When I first learned this, the focus, the attention is focused on the rim of the nostrils as the primary target. Now, I focus on the sensations that I notice when the air comes in the nose, but also travels, when it travels down to the lungs, it swishes into the mouth. When you have your tongue, unless if you have your tongue pressed to the top, it won't work, but then it hits the gums above the teeth and hits the soft tissue inside the upper lip. And there's a sensation there. And then when I exhale, the air kind of moves in that area. Normally, it's natural. And strikes that. And so my target is the upper lip and gum and the area around the nose. So I did that for some period of time. I mean, I'm not using a stopwatch. Maybe a quarter of the third of the 45 minutes. And then I started to move my attention around my face, upper lips, lower lips, jaw, so forth and so on, the eye sockets, forehead, top of the head, so forth and so on. So my whole head, I was aware of it as a kind of a vibratory field. And then I would move it down my shoulders, both arms down to my fingertips, and then down my torso and my legs and my feet. And so what it's doing is tapping into a function of the nervous system that's always operating, part of being alive. You know what happens when your hand goes to sleep? That tingling sensation. Well, that tingling sensation, not quite that sharp, but it's there everywhere, all the time. And the intention to track that starts out being sort of, I'd mentioned in discrete areas, but then it becomes something that kind of I can be aware of in the whole body. And so I just sit with that. And when I'm sitting with that, every time I exhale, I release and open as far as that out-breath will go. And then do it again, and then do it again. And it's not like I'm trying to make more sensation happen. It's just more like a surrendering into the fullness of the experience. And that's my practice. Now, on a retreat, I would want to be in that zone for a long period of time with an open-minded curiosity. And basically, in that kind of level of practice, the interest in discerning where the body leaves off and the rest of the sensational world begins becomes irrelevant. Just don't care anymore. And that's called bhanga. You may have heard that on the retreat, Brandon. I don't know.
I have a question.
What? Just a second. Yeah. And so I get into that state and just keep opening and opening and opening. It wasn't like that today. It was just sort of like getting into this whole body awareness. It's very restful and stabilizes attention. So it's basically advancing the functioning of the aiming and sustaining that begins when you start investigating the breath. So the aiming and sustaining becomes more and more full body kind of vibe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That starts to operate the awakening factors, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. That tracks, like, actually with my experience as well. When you talk about the bhanga, is that, can you tell me just a little bit more about that? Are you losing sense of your body? Like, is your body disappearing?
Well, the body doesn't disappear. It's that my interest in discerning where the body leaves off and sounds and temperatures and breezes and odors, all that stuff, just it all kind of becomes unified.
Right.
It's a holistic experience. It's all inclusive.
Yeah.
And just hang out there with curiosity. Yes, sir.
It's really quick because I've had others. I mean, I was in there with 70 other people. Is it just experience? Because it's very hard. I showed up a couple months ago and I accidentally fell into this. How do you explain to somebody how to go there without saying, just sit 3 hours a day, just keep going?
I just have to say, Peter, that we can't hear that. I can hear you, but I can't hear the person in the room. Can you just repeat his question for those of us on the Zoom?
So what I hear you saying is how, this is Brandon asking the question.
Okay.
How can you do that in a room full of 70 people without sitting for, or in any context, without sitting for 3 or 4 hours?
How do you explain it to some? I mean, because we can explain the whole process, but when someone hasn't, when you've experienced that, there's a zest about it. You're not asleep. You're not tired.
No, nope, not
sitting
tired.
You're experiencing.
Right. So how do we explain that?
Somebody, how do you, you know, somebody who's only been meditating for a couple months? Hey, look.
Well, how do you, this thing
that's going to happen if you keep going?
How do you tell someone who's just learning how to play the guitar how to find that harmony and that
analogy taken?
Right?
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's a mystery. I call it the aha moment. Yeah. There comes a time where your conceptual understanding starts to be supported or validated by your actual subjective experience. Yeah. So, does that clarify for you, April?
What was the last thing you said? Sorry.
The question is how do you explain what this is to anyone?
Mm-hmm.
And what I said was that you have a conceptual understanding of the Dharma,
right?
But when you get deeply into your practice, the aha moment kind of validates the concepts, and that's really what the Buddhist conceptual world, that's what faith is.
Shraddha
is the Pali word. Faith is confidence. It's not necessarily a faith that's externalized to some, you know, supernatural being. It's that you understand how this works at a deeper level that's more satisfying, more beneficial.
Yeah, I actually heard an interesting thing today it was one of the Clear Monastery podcast episodes, and they were saying that the confidence, it's like when you see that the teachings are true through your experience, you know, that you experience the suffering, you experience the acknowledgement of it, and then you start to experience, you know, the fruits of the practice. Basically, the faith is built upon the experiential knowledge of the teachings, and it doesn't require believing a credo. You know, it doesn't require believing like rules, basically, that you experience it. But there are guidelines to get you set up for the experience. What I think is interesting is like hearing you describe your practice. You know, it's an interesting process to put into words what you're experiencing. And I am finding the more that I hear different experienced meditators describe it, the more that I can find some relation like that makes sense to what I'm experiencing as well. And then it's also fascinating because there are so many different styles and techniques. And lately I've even been listening to well-known teachers who are trained in many different techniques describe the different results from the different techniques, right? So you have some choice in this practice. But yes, long story short to say, yes, the aha moment is very rewarding.
Yes. Yes. Other Dharma questions? Yes, Steve.
Just continue the conversation, and this gets into what April was saying also with the different methods of meditation. So for, say, the guitar analogy, how do you tell somebody how to do XYZ on the guitar? What I would tell them, what I have told people, is don't get ahead of yourself. You know, don't use back technique and try to play beyond your ability. Try to play something too fast when you can't really do that and you learn the wrong way. I think there's a parallel with meditation on that, at least insofar as not expecting yourself to be further along than you are and not getting discouraged at that. Then I would tell them to find a way to enjoy what they're doing. Two, practice. More practice is necessary. And then number three, enjoy what you're doing. That's what I would tell somebody. And that probably translates to meditation practice as well, even if that is finding a tradition that you might resonate with better, or finding within the tradition you chose some sort of parameters or a sangha or something to make that more palatable or natural or enjoyable, less unnecessary resistance to the act. I don't know. But that's really interesting, because that has me drawing parallels with other things in terms of the practice that might be useful for me, because I've taught guitar to people before, so it's kind of firing my brain on that analogy. So right. Sharing that out loud.
Part of the problem is that a lot of what we train for with musicians or athletics or dancing or something like that, there's an external an externalizing of it, which is to say, when you play the guitar, it's either going to sound good or it's going to not sound good. What makes the music happen is the ability of the person to not fall into the doubt or discouragement that comes because they can't quickly get praised for their musicianship, right? Because we live in a world that prompts us externally. I mean, it's always been that way. And with the meditation practice, that's a very much an inside job. And the judge of whether we're successful or not is not outside of us. It's inside us, right? I judge myself because, damn, I got distracted again, right? More practice is necessary.
Damn it, I hit the wrong note. Yeah.
Right. Or damn it, I hit the wrong note. But then that wrong note, somebody else can hear. But with the meditation practice, nobody knows but me. Right? So that's I think, an important thing to understand is that somebody might verbally explain something to me about meditation, Dharma talk. I might read about it. I certainly have. And then the practice is to internalize that, to make it subjectively valid, the aha moment. That's how it happens. But that's still private. It's still private. And if someone starts to externalize that about what a perfect meditator they are, right, that doesn't work. It doesn't work because it's being prompted by having to maintain a reputation for being a perfect meditator, right? And if you know inside that, nah, I still get distracted, but you have to pretend, then that doesn't work, right? And that's one thing that I'm grateful for in myself. I've been doing this for half my life. My mind still gets distracted. All right, more practice is necessary. But the joy is the practice. It doesn't depend on whether someone gives me an attaboy at all. I do it because it's very interesting. Even the difficult times are very interesting. You know? So that's, I think, an important distinction to make. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally does. That's something. These analogies are great vehicles to unpack these sort of things.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people lose kind of like lose that point in the practice. And I think once sometimes we get to that point of euphoria, I think people just want to look into that and then lose completely the point of the practice.
Right.
It's going to happen. Like, if you got very concentrated, your body's going to react to it. And that's why you feel like you're, like, levitating or whatever.
Yeah.
And sometimes people just get focused on that. And for them, that's good meditation. But it's, like, you're losing the point of actually, like, being still in your mind and things like that.
Yeah, the euphoria can really be a trap.
Yeah.
You know, I've had some jhana experiences. My first one was on a Goenka retreat, actually. And that became like my primary goal for years. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I determined whether it was a good meditation or not. And then I realized that that's a mistake. Mm-hmm. That it really is, it's not about concentration, it's about insight. But it's important to have a sufficient stability of attention in order for the insight process to work effectively. So concentration is important, but it's not like that sharp, one-pointed concentration for jhana. It's more along the lines of what I was talking about with that bhanga, that there's a stability, a unified field of awareness that doesn't really, isn't reactive. It's just open and curious. And for me, that's an interesting part of why I do this is that. But even that can become a goal. You know, I can get wrapped around the notion that, well, I didn't experience the bhanga, so what's wrong with me? Nothing. There's no me to have be wrong with. It's just causes and conditions were not sufficient. More practice is necessary. And without shame or without pride, more practice is necessary.
Those are some of the biggest points that they kept bringing up the whole week. That was some of the biggest points that they kept bringing up is don't get caught in the sensations.
Right.
Your pain is
or in sensation. What the mind wants from the sensation.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Constantly saying,
Yep. They're on their retreat. They were saying over and over again, don't get hooked into those expectations. April.
Yeah, I was just going to share a quote from the Rodney Smith podcast I heard today where he actually said, don't ever try to hunt down something in your meditation. Like that hunting it down is like you won't get there because you're it's like too much effort basically.
Yeah, once again, that brings to mind a phrase that stayed with me for a long time. It's from Korean Zen, a gateless gate. You know, the practice, we have aspirations for liberation, but when they become fixations or test cases, it doesn't work.
Almost seems like to not make a big deal out of a bad set, you should make a big deal out of a good one.
Exactly.
Equanimity with the whole thing.
Yes. Whether it's good or bad, equanimity, yes.
That's why those levels in the mind illuminated kind of, I was skeptical of that at first, you know, because it's easy to get hung up on that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, have a big fun now. Yes, Satish?
Just make a comment. The way I see it, the way I do it, it has to be goalless, no goal, no judgment, and it's all in the practice. You do it on a regular basis, and whatever comes out of it, comes out of it.
It's the journey. The journey is very interesting for me.
Yeah.
And I you know, I sit twice a day, and each time I sit, there's this curiosity, what's going to happen this time? And it's not judgmental. It's just, what's going to happen this time? Very interesting.
Someone said to me some time back that there's a different meditation for every person. And I know a little bit about acting, and it's the same with that. You have to find the way you do it. You can sort of get a book on it. And I think there comes a point where you can when you become imaginative and creative with it, that's when there's a kind of shift.
Oh, my practice has changed a lot over the decades. I started out with noticing at the nostrils. Mm. The first person who taught me was a woman named Ruth Dennison at the Insight Meditation Society in 1972. I did that for a little while. Then I started to practice with the expanding and contracting of the abdomen as the target for attention, right? So I did that for a while. Then I went on the Goenka retreats and shifted back to the nose. And now I just described to you what my practice is today. And it's because of that kind of informed experimentation. Don't be sloppy about it. Be somewhat well-informed conceptually about how the process works. Listen to people who have some competency in that and try it out. You know, there's a phrase in Buddhism, ehi pasiko, and it's translated as come and see. Come and see. Try it out. See what happens. So that leads to that kind of making the best fit for your age, your circumstances, you know, so forth and so on. You just make the best fit.
What I meant was that once you've done all, you know, followed the manuals and everything, there comes a point where, I mean, it's very hard to describe, but not that long back, I suddenly thought, well, what do I think about this? Because it was like all the time I was thinking along the lines of what I'd been told and what I'd read, which was excellent, excellent stuff. But once I thought, well, actually, I can myself think what I think of this, because that's what all the other people. And then I find that at that point you can start to develop your own way into it.
Yep.
Yeah, that's not easy to talk about, but
that's how it works.
Yeah. And it might be something quite original. You know, it's what works for you.
Oh, no, it's not quite original. It is original. Mm. I mean, that's the thing to understand is that we are creating reality. You know, I don't mean that I'm making the world happen, you know, but my subjectivity is unique. And the moment of that subjectivity is unique. So, yeah, everybody has to find their own way. The last words out of the Buddha's mouth when he was dying was, work out your own salvation with diligence. And that diligence, that's a really important term.
Yeah, to me, what everything you say, that you've been doing it for years, that's the main part. That you have discipline, you do it every, you know, very regularly, and for all this length, that is what I aspire to. That's it. No other goal. No goal.
Right. Yeah. Right. So Jim Rottweiler just posted this for those of you in the room here. The student asked the master how long it would take to achieve success with meditation. The master replied, 10 years. The student said, but what if I try really hard? The master said, in that case, 20 years.
20 years. It's like getting ahead of yourself.
Yes. Other questions? Comments?
There's no other question. I have a question.
Go for it.
You know more both about Buddhism and Advaita, right?
Yes.
What's the difference in your mind?
I can speak more authoritatively about Buddhism than Advaita.
Okay.
I can't remember the names of the Advaita masters that I've read about. Advaita is, for those who are not familiar with it, is a form of Buddhist spirituality or meditation practice. And there's a school of Buddhism, Madhyamaka, and it's very similar to the Advaita school in its understanding. Madhyamaka just basically says anything you can possibly imagine is not real, including your ability to imagine it. There's no you to imagine it. And that's, I think that's a core focus of Advaita. I think it's woven into the fabric of Zen as well. But that's my comment about that, the intersection between Advaita Vedanta and Buddhist Dharma.
You talk about Advaita, you didn't talk about Buddhism, right? You didn't talk about Buddhism, you talked about Advaita.
Well, yeah, Madhyamaka is part of Buddhism. That's just one of the schools of Buddhism.
I thought they're totally different. Like Buddhism, I understand, is emptiness. And whereas Advaita, it's fullness to the extent of...
Yes.
Yeah.
I prefer to think of the Buddhist term sunyata as being translated as fullness rather than emptiness. So in that way, in that way, that's similar to Advaita Vedanta.
Okay.
That the whole notion of emptiness, the way it's described is that empty, it's empty of an observer and empty of that which is observed. The reality is has that quality. So then if we were going to flip it, when I was talking about being in that vibrational body zone and losing interest in the mind making any distinction between where my body left off and the rest of the universe begins, that kind of sets a stage. And as far as I'm concerned, where that would lead is to a complete disinterest in even any kind of notion that there's an observer and something that's being observed. And that's Madhyamaka. And it's also Advaita. So I think back in the day, these people were talking to each other on a regular basis back we call it the Middle Ages of Buddhism, the 5th and 6th century, I guess, of the Common Era. And so that distinction was probably debated about a lot back in the day. And now, because of the internet, the debate's happening again, which I find to be very interesting and exciting, that the doctrines of these various mystical traditions, including Sufism and Christian mysticism and Jewish mysticism, they're all kind of coming together. It's a kind of a common understanding amongst people who are really dedicated practitioners and have some insight, that, you know, all these interactions are going on via the internet and in person amongst all these different traditions that have been operating separately for centuries, millennia. I think that's very, very exciting for spiritual resurgence in the world. I think it's really cool. Other questions or comments?
Yeah, the relationship between Thomas Merton and Thich Nhat Hanh.
Thomas Merton, the Christian mystic, and Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen Buddhist master.
In the monasteries, they've always, it really doesn't matter what tradition.
Yep.
If you really go in, you're going somewhere similar.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the Dalai Lama was at a monastery in Kentucky, I think, for a conference with the monks there. And he was walking down the hall, and there was a statue of the Virgin Mary, and he stopped and he bowed to it, and sincerely. And the monk with him was surprised, and he said, "Well, sure, why not?" But I personally think that Tibetan Buddhism is the Roman Catholicism of the Buddhist world. There's so many different deities and bodhisattvas and so forth and so on. It's very similar to the Catholic tradition. Mm-hmm. And those
the symbolism outweighs the practice.
Right. Right. Well, but the symbolism can be
not
very
outweighs the practice because they're pretty hardcore. But
yeah, the symbolism is useful, right, up to a point. But you know, any kind of strategy is useful up to a point. Then you have to drop it all in order for it to really liberate. And I think so. The whole notion of what we're doing or chanting or rituals or anything like that takes to a certain level, but then all that has to drop away. And to me, that's part of the brilliance of Buddhism. The original meaning of sati, which we understand as mindfulness, had to do with the ability of a Brahmin priest to accurately remember the rites and rituals and perform them without error, over and over again, in order for the spiritual development of that person or that community. And so the Buddha said that, yes, we want to remember that, you know, greed, hatred, and ignorance cause dukkha. We want to remember that, remember impermanence and non-self are important, you know, insights. Don't forget that. So the whole notion of being non-forgetful was changed from some kind of routine ritual to the discipline of insight. But even then, we have to drop the discipline of aiming and sustaining and all the kind of meditative efforts that we go through and just be open. An ultimate letting go.
I did have a question for you from your experience, because I had a moment where I realized that, and we're talking about all the other religions right now, it would seem that the religions that play around in that energy field, that what I like about Buddhism is we're just supposed to, with equanimity, go through that, go past that, and not get attached to it. But it would seem like all of the, everything from charismatic to kundalini and all of those forms of Sufism where they have these, where they do these activities that stir up that a certain level of ecstatic energy, we just sit and watch it arise and then go through it.
I think that a dedicated practitioner in any of the religions of spirituality would get the same place. I think that it's just, there comes a point when there's a realization that whatever kind of conceptual structure was organized around, you know, rebirth or the Buddha, Jesus being resurrected from the dead, or the miracles of Islam and Judaism and so forth and so on. Up to a point when a person gets to a certain level of awakening, they realize that that's an obstacle. And so it just becomes more and more open.
Yeah.
You know, I've used a metaphor often of a great mountain out in the middle of the vastness of the world. Huge, tall mountain. And all these different tribes living around the base of the mountain. Some of them grow up in a field. Others grow up in a jungle. Others grow up in a desert. Others grow up on the seashore. you know, there's others grew up in the city, right?
Yeah.
So all these tribes have a notion of this is what reality is. And they, but they're all, certain numbers of them are curious about what's up there, what's up the mountainside. And so they start to climb. And that's what spiritual practice is. And they might have different strategies because of different terrain, you know, to get up over a cliff where the other one might just be walking up a slope. And the higher up they get, the more they encounter each other. And if they stop there and start arguing about who's got the better tools, right? Who's the smarter one? They get stuck there, or they fall down, right? But there's some of them who, at that level, are still curious, and they kind of have a sense that, yeah, well, you got this far, I got this far. Let's see what we can do. Go further, and the farther up they get, up the slope toward the peak, the more they cooperate. The more they understand each other, and the more they can look out over the countryside and understand why there's so much difference in a person's approach to spiritual development. And get to the peak, they all understand the same thing.
Yeah.
Right? To me, that's a really interesting metaphor for this process of awakening and the journey. They're just, people get hung up. And I certainly have struggled with that over the decades, is certain things that I have to get done. Now I just want to open. But I still have to set up the conditions for that to be maximally beneficial. You know, it really is a certain kind of finesse in terms of how you pay attention to your subjectivity that is important to develop in this kind of endeavor. Satish.
I think common thread in different religions is different ways to de-emphasize the self, either with devotion or with just knowing there is no me or something like that. I think that's the common thread. I could be wrong, but that's the common thread, because the focus on self is the cause of what you call dukkha.
Right.
I don't think that's the case for Christian religions, because you have the spirit, and the spirit at the end is the one that's going
to
be saved.
Yeah, but the spirit, you give it to spirit.
Yeah, but that's a something that you have inside, and Buddhism is like, there's nothing.
No, Buddhism doesn't say there's nothing. What Buddhism says is that there's an inherent... desire is not the right word, but there's an inherent inclination toward what in Christianity would be concerned, you know, the liberation of the soul or the reunification of the soul with God.
Like we were saying earlier, it depends on who you're talking to. My mom would tell you that there is no her and that there's only God, and she's as devout Christian as you can get. Mm-hmm. It just depends on what Christian if you're talking about the masses, it doesn't matter what religion it is,
or what who if you know someone who's Muslim or Jewish.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's got their the culture has shaped how people understand liberation or spiritual evolution. I think that spirituality in its purest form is an evolutionary trend.
Yeah.
For humanity. And because of culture, different cultures, there's a different kind of understanding of what that looks like and how to do that. And going back to what I was saying before about this era, all these different spiritual people are talking to each other. And I think something new is going to come from it. Maybe not in my lifetime, but certainly sometime in the next, you know, century, there's going to be a whole new understanding of what spirituality means that may or may not have anything to do with an organized religion. It may create, some people say that science is the new religion. That could be. you know, the whole notion of scientific investigation could be another approach to what we could call human spiritual development. We don't know, but I think it's useful for us to be practicing, you know, training the mind and talking to each other about it like we're doing right now. I think it's really important.
Peter?
Yes, April.
Yeah, I had a comment that was directly related to that. I was listening to Jed Brewer, I think it's Jed Brewer, the addiction expert who's also a meditator and also runs neuroscience studies. And he was actually saying that, you know, they bring in meditators, they bring in people who they've just taught how to meditate and they do the fMRI scans. And they also bring in, you know, decades long experienced meditators and they compare. And they also, because he's a psychologist as well as a researcher, he said there was an interesting study where they took cognitive therapy, like people who do the, you know, all of the mental reframes and all of the different like techniques for cognitive, what is it? CBT anyway.
Or mindfulness based cognitive therapy.
But the key here is that the ones who were not doing meditation were not getting the same results. Like basically he was saying that thought alone, like they're kind of going back to what we were talking about in the beginning of this conversation earlier, is there is something experientially happening with the way, you know, we know that we're using neuroplasticity and rewiring the brain. So there is actually something happening with contemplative practice. And, you know, I'm not an expert in this at all, but I do know that a lot of different religions have different contemplative, you know, practices. Also, what you're saying about the science is that, yeah, basically all of this research is pointing to which techniques are measurable in the brain, you know, and so one of the things he also said was that the difference between the ones they had just taught meditation that day and then had them go into the scans versus the decades long ones was that they're, you know, absolutely seeing a difference in the way the brain is firing and, you know, what's lighting up there. So, yeah. And I think a lot of people are saying what you were just saying is that when you start to combine all of these elements that you will be able to measure the changes. And so depending on what your goal is, right. But if people's goal is to quiet down the default mode network and experience more joy, you know, it's more and more that they can actually measure that with the brain scans and they can actually track which types of practices, attention practices are leading to those goals.
Yeah. The what's, I think, interesting about Buddhism, which is by far the most thoroughly investigated, you know, by science and psychology, the most thoroughly investigated spiritual practice, is because the conceptual structure of the Dharma, the teaching, lends itself to scientific experimentation because it's based on noticing cause and effect. And, you know, that's what you put somebody in a functional MRI and you give them something to concentrate on, that giving that something is a cause and the effect is what happens in the brain. And they can measure that change in the brain and make some kind of correlation with what the stimulus was. You can't do that with other traditions that don't have that kind of conceptual structure. So for me, that's really fascinating. I was a Buddhist before I went to grad school to become a counselor. And so I brought the Dharma with me to grad school and I would talk about it in the courses with my classmates, and they were kind of baffled. They thought it was some kind of new age thing, which is ironic, right? 25 centuries plus on the planet. And just did not understand it. And then I started working as an addictions counselor. and would teach people who are trying to recover from addiction how to practice mindfulness meditation and loving kindness meditation. And up until fairly recently, some of them would show up on the residential retreats that I was leading. But the change was happening as I was beginning my career. And now the whole notion of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and meditation training for relapse prevention is becoming kind of the norm in the field. So that's part of what excites me about this era, is that, you know, I'm in it kind of the beginning of it, and it's going to be really interesting to see where it goes. So somebody had over here had a question, was it? No?
No, I was going to say something. But
okay, go ahead.
Well, I was, you were talking about changes in the brain. I was just reading a couple of days ago that...
Speak louder, please.
They found that a Tibetan breathing practice, which was breathing into four, holding it for seven, and then breathing out to eight, they could see that I'm not sure what part of the brain, but it actually altered something in the cortex at the front.
Yeah, the preorbital cortex.
Yeah.
The right preorbital cortex, yeah, to be
so
specific.
Even a breathing exercise.
Oh, yeah. That's also been shown in the Hindu traditions as well.
Yeah.
The yogic traditions.
And on the way here, there was a program on public broadcasting that they were working with people to do imaginative work about people that they didn't get on with, and then imagine themselves with the person. And one instance was where they were together dangling their feet in the water and things like that. And they found there were changes in the brain from them doing that as well.
Oh, yeah.
And they found that their relations with those people through that creative imagination.
Right.
It improved that a woman with her mother, if she hadn't spoken to her for years, and then finally sort of spoke to her, and it went much better than it would have done.
There's not too many steps from that you just described about people sitting there with their feet in the water and people who were in conflict and having their brainwaves checked and that they were somehow or other altered by that for the betterment of the relationship. Mm-hmm. That's well known in the Tibetan tradition. It's called Tonglen, compassion meditation.
This was a science program, so science is catching up with that.
Science has been studying Tonglen for a long time.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Peter.
Oh. Sharon.
Hey, this is interesting when you're talking about different cultures, and I had a great deal of experience with various cultures, but my own, when I was a small child, when I was a little girl, my parents took us to, we joined an Orthodox Jewish synagogue. And I got to tell you, it was fascinating to me. The men would, it's called davening, and they would rock back and forth. Back
and forth. I used to do that. And you probably saw me do that in this room.
Well, standing up. They're usually standing up. And the thing is, you stand up, you sit down. And I didn't know what the heck was going on, but I was captivated that early.
That's rapture.
Yeah.
Now, some of it might have been performance, that they did it because they thought they were supposed to. But stay with me.
Oh, no.
But I can tell you from my own experience, sitting in this room, there was a time during my meditation career when I wouldn't decide to do this. My body would just start to rock forward and back. And if you look in the Buddhist doctrine teachings, that's one of the signs of rapture. There's a treatise called the Visuddhimagga. It's in that.
Well, as a child, I could actually pick it up. What I wanted to say is I could pick it up and feel it. I could feel it, literally. It was an energy that filled whatever space we were in, which would have been, you know, in a space. None of it was, I don't believe any of it, because I was observing the whole thing. What else could I do because I was there? You know, wasn't really understanding except observing, mostly. Also, I kind of was thinking about the whirling dervishes that we've, most people have had some knowledge of that kind of rapture, which is, again, very similar. And even
that's in the Islamic Sufi tradition.
Thank you. I couldn't remember. But I can remember seeing and I know the different positions in Islam. There's a focus on, and of course, in these cultures, men and women are separated. I have to say that.
At Goenka retreats, men and women are separated.
Oh, how do you know that?
Yeah, completely.
That's interesting. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, the idea is to reduce any kind of sexual impulse.
Distraction.
That might happen. Any attraction, right? That's what it's for.
Wow.
So, yeah. And, you know, I've been in all kinds of retreat situations. Didn't seem to make any difference to me whether there was a woman sitting next to me or no women in sight. And, you know, the eating, you know, the dining rooms are separated. Everything's different. I mean, completely isolated from one another. But that's, once again, they're attempting to set up environmental circumstances that decrease the likelihood of a person being unsuccessful at their spiritual development.
Or being distracted.
But being distracted, which is, that's equivalent.
Have a notebook, can you order a book?
Yep. Half the attendees are from 19 to 32.
Oh, good. Half the attendees at the Goenka retreats are from 19 to 32. That's good.
You had a lot of interaction.
I mean, I was that age when I first went and did one of those retreats.
Yeah.
So, other questions or comments?
I got one.
Yes, Steve.
So, when I was young, I noticed that one of my buddies, when his wife would get mad at him in the same room, he'd start humming. He would never do that otherwise. It was sort of like plugging his ears, not really kind of getting his mind off the fact that his wife's not happy with him. It was a funny pattern I noticed, and it reminded me of sort of plugging your ears, when you don't want to hear something someone wants to say. When I'm meditating, sometimes I have that relationship with the breathing almost, because it's like I'm not going to get distracted. Okay, breath, you know, just really almost aggressively attaching to the breath sometimes, and I find that that settles into a calmer state. But I find that sort of maybe overreaching to stay attached to the breath is much more constructive than being unknowingly distracted from the breath.
Well, now see, that falls into the same kind of pattern that we was talking about with Robert, in terms of you have to kind of find your way to what really works for you. And I'm still finding my way, right?
Yeah.
And so for you to be mindful, cause and effect,
yeah.
You breathe a bit more forcefully,
yeah.
There, this happens up to a point, and often what happens up to a point is that your mind just simply lets go of that and settles into a quieter pattern.
Yeah, it's true.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, or it continues for the whole meditation. I mean, trust me, I've had all these kinds of experiences, but the bottom line of it is the intention to investigate in a non-reactive way to what the mind is creating. And the longer you can stay with something like the breath or the body scan, you know, that unified field, so to speak, the easier it is to notice more and more subtle manifestations of selfing, which is something that's going to be, that's in the Mind Illuminated, a book that we're involved with the study group. Any final questions before we wrap it up for the evening?
This is not bragging. I do want to point this out about the scanning. There is a point, and I don't know whether this is physiological or whether it's psychosomatic or maybe they're intertwined, but you do get to where when your awareness moves, you start feeling it in your bone.
Oh, yeah.
Like something's pushing your teeth out. Like,
yeah, that's what I was just talking about.
I told the teacher this one. It was the strangest feeling. I was scanning,
And it was like my stomach, this is weird, but it was like my stomach felt my awareness pass by it.
Yeah.
It was just...
Oh, really, the marrow of your bones.
Really, yeah.
You can be aware of it in the marrow of your bones.
But
what that's meant to do is to create a kind of platform, a stabilizing point of reference that you hang out in with curiosity and a willingness to let go. Right? That's how it works. And beyond that, it's very, very subtle, and I'm very, very curious about it.
Yeah, because it makes me want to wonder, what is it that's causing, because I don't feel that right now. I mean, there's nothing happening right here unless I stop and look at it, and then you can start.
What's causing it is the preponderance of wholesome mind conditioning functions. Those two charts on the wall here, you know, the wholesome mind conditioners. There's something that changes in the way the various neural pathways in the brain interact that support that kind of awareness. Alternatively, when there's something else going on in the environment or how you're metabolizing the food that you ate or how much exercise you got that day, you know, all these different variables, they're going to be part of what produces this moment of consciousness. The idea is to become more and more intimately and non-reactively aware of how that process plays out and see what happens. Yeah. That's the way it works.
The question was going to be, is that happening all the time and we're not aware of it?
It's what happening all the time?
It's what's happening. Like pressure and stuff and all these things.
Yeah.
We're just not aware of it because we're not paying attention to it.
Become more sensitive to it because your mind's not diffused.
Diffused.
It's more...
Right. So they come into the field. We don't know we're breathing.
Right.
You don't go through the day knowing that you're breathing.
Yeah, you don't. You're not.
Yeah, the breathing stops. The breathing just stops. The out breath becomes very, very long. And I just don't care whether it starts again or not. And it does. But it's very quiet in that long, 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 long out breath. Very quiet. Very stable and peaceful. And a place to be resting. Attention. Okay. So, very interesting discussions tonight. All right, I have an announcement, upcoming events. The cadre of teachers for Orlando Insight, two of whom are with us, the third person had to leave early. April and Allie are part of our gathering of teachers, and Susan, but she had to leave. We're going to start reviewing the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And next week, I'm going to be giving the talk, but it's going to be an overview of the Satipatthana, a kind of a big picture of what it is, where it comes from in the Dharma, the teachings, and, you know, how it fits together. And then after that, we're going to systematically have different teachers giving talks on the different aspects of the Four Foundations, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, et cetera, et cetera. So, upcoming events.
What's it called again?
Satipatthana. All right. So, it's our custom to sit together briefly at the end of the meeting. Thank you for your practice. Wish you well, and I hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy till the next time we have a chance to chat.